He's going to join midway through the recording. Not midway, but in about 5 or 10 minutes or so.
Okay.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a very special guest today. For all of you that have ever questioned the game, or for anybody that's ever tried to see the game from a different lens, we have the one and only. You know, I'll let him introduce himself. Go ahead, Coach.
Hi. Well, I'm Coach Nick from B-Ball Breakdown, and I'm happy to be here.
That's great. That's great. Let's jump right into the conversation here. I've got my questions on the side. So, Coach Nick, there's been a lot of coaching changes in this offseason. Some questionable, a lot questionable, almost all of them questionable. Probably the most polarizing one was the Lakers situation. What are your thoughts on JJ Redick becoming the new Lakers head coach?
You know, it's not unprecedented that someone who hasn't had any head coaching experience takes over an NBA team. You don't have to look very far. Steve Kerr did it, and he was very successful very early. So that said, he did have a lot of experience, I think, as a GM. And then actually weirdly similar experience to JJ in the NBA as a player. So, you know, I would willing to say, you know, it's not a prerequisite. I mean, it seems like, you know, having some version of like coaching experience would be a good thing as a head coach. But, you know, it's hard to tell you that it's not going to work when it has worked somewhat recently in the modern game. So, you know, I suppose that what's interesting about it is the method with which this whole thing played out. And that might be probably the most interesting part of it, because at the very least, with what we were able to see from JJ and LeBron on that podcast or on that YouTube channel, there is no questioning the fact that JJ has a really good command of the X's and O's. He seems to really understand that. So that's, you know, that I'll definitely make sure to make that clear, that he seems to me to be someone who understands the game in that way.
Well, you think that there's validity to the whole podcast tampering like situation? You think that there's validity to that?
I mean, listen, did it enter JJ's mind when they started this thing? And, you know, the only thing I thought was interesting, and I said this on my show, was that normally a show like this would have probably been planned right when the season ends. And then they have maybe like all summer to kind of plan it, design the set, the whole thing. And then they kind of figure it out and then they launch it, at, you know, at a certain time. This comes up in the middle of the year. I think their first episode was in January at some point. So that was just kind of interesting to me that LeBron was going to take something like that on, you know, in the middle of the year. And also with JJ, who's in the middle of having to cover, you know, all these games and all that stuff, because Doc Rivers took the job in Milwaukee. So, you know, that was interesting. But there's no question in my mind that it must have flashed into JJ's head. Darvin Ham is someone that's been maligned and has got a lot of intense pressure from the Laker fans and Laker community. And, you know, this will probably be a nice thing to kind of connect with LeBron and have that out there. So I have to imagine it was on his mind. Was it on anyone else's mind? I can't tell you. But, you know, I think we'd be foolish to say that JJ wasn't thinking about this when it started.
Okay. I do want to ask, too, specifically about the Lakers situation. Do you think that there was any legs to, like, I'm going to let Domo up. You think there was any legs to Dan Hurley being a potential coach in the game, or that was just smoke?
Very, very strange. As soon as it came out, I was on a couple other shows telling him, like, no, he's not taking that job. Like, he was not going to leave. So I never felt like it was a serious thing. He did come out, apparently, to L.A., but, you know, there was weird. I had heard another story. Again, are we here for innuendo? Can we talk about rumors? Because I guess we can all do that, right? Yeah. There was some notion that he lost his leverage with the Kentucky thing in terms of signing an extension with UConn, and that was a mistake. He should have milked that a lot longer. He probably would have been able to get a better extension then. So they needed help. They needed some way to generate another version of leverage for him. Along comes the Lakers thing where he could really play it up, knowing he wasn't going to take it. He got the extension, I believe, right? I think UConn gave it to him out of this, I believe. Mm-hmm. I'm not crazy. So, like, that could very well be what it was part of. And, you know, if you want to, you know, throw Woj into this, you know, someone who is very, very closely connected to the Hurley family, you know, if they needed to create this notion of, oh, looking at him all along, that doesn't make a lot of sense to me that they were really doing that either. So maybe they were all kind of using each other. Maybe the Lakers were using this as a way to show, oh, we weren't really interested in JJ. You know, we're doing our due diligence here. Didn't work out with Hurley. Well, okay, now we're going to hire JJ. Like, you know, I think maybe everyone was kind of helping each other out on this one and to get the results they all wanted.
Hi, Coach. How are we doing today?
All right. What's happening?
Chilling.
Got the whole collective here. Okay. I guess it's funny because he came out and said, and mind you, why wouldn't he say, hey, this wasn't a ploy to get me some more money? Why wouldn't he say that, right? But
yeah, I mean, you know, can't really say that, I think, if you're trying to negotiate with the team, with UConn, for instance. But, you know, the idea that they wouldn't give him an extension of whatever he wanted at this point is silly to me, too, because the guy just won back-to-back championships.
Yeah.
He is undisputedly the best college basketball coach. You know, whether he's going to, you know, his head's going to explode one day on the sideline or not, with the way he coaches is another issue. And he, you know, he has professed, he has said he's evolved, because you have to remember the other context here is that his father was also, you know, a winning coach, won more than hardly anybody has ever won before. But I've been to a practice of Bob Hurley, and it was kind of frightening the way he would treat players in the high school level. And we know that Danny was very similar in coaching that same way. And he said he's evolved and understood the detrimental effects that has. But if there's anything that I do on my show, I kind of go out and try and make sure that discussion is had about optimal ways to communicate to players. The Bobby Knight style, which was accepted for all those years, for decades and decades, is not the optimal way. Mm-hmm. And you might be able to get some results out of that, but I would like to think that because Danny evolved, like you said, he has, and has not used anger and disgust the way his father did all those years, that might have gotten them to that next level where they now are winning as much as they are.
I would want to see, even if it's not with the Lakers, of course, because they already signed their coach, because every clip, every video, every game, he does look like he's about to just blow his top. I do want to see how that works on a pro level.
Right.
Specifically, and especially with like older guys. That was probably the most interesting thing about the whole Lakers thing, is because I would love to see him yell at LeBron. Because LeBron is, well, maybe LeBron doesn't yell at, but I would love to see LeBron's reaction, like 38-year-old LeBron looking at him like, are you serious right now?
Right. Well, I'd like to see Danny Hurley's reaction when he realizes that LeBron is behind him signaling or saying something like over his shoulder to somebody while he's trying to coach him, which we've seen LeBron do as well. You know, and that's why it's interesting how this is all going to work. Because does JJ know what he's getting into? Does LeBron maybe so completely accept JJ that he will back off a little bit or not? And it's not saying that LeBron shouldn't be involved in the coaching of a team. He has that IQ that few players do, but you certainly can't like be a player coach. It's too many variables to deal with while you have to do the load that he has on the court, and then have to try and keep your eye on and manage other things, which I think there are times he tries to do. So it's going to be an interesting thing. I don't think that JJ is going to have the kind of success that like Steve Kerr had as a newbie coach coming in and taking over a team. You know, that's what's more interesting to me anyways, because with a team like this, it has LeBron and AD, who did play a lot of games last year together, that I don't know if you can really say the injury thing is really what hurt them. They definitely did not perform that well, bottom line. And, you know, I think their playoff results also mirrored what they did in the regular season. So what does it say about a team that does have LeBron and AD playing a whole bunch of games without the injury issue, unable to win a lot of games? That's probably the more startling thing to me as anything else.
Yeah. Let's move a little to the East Coast. They haven't decided or finalized what was going on. I think we might have talked about this last time you were on, but the Detroit Pistons let go of Monty Williams after a year and a boatload of money. Thoughts on that? Because honestly, although I understand there might have been some issues with Monty and his style and everything like that, a year is not enough time to me, in my personal opinion, especially if you have $100 billion tied up into a coach just like that.
You know, it probably would be worth, I have to admit, I didn't watch a lot of Pistons games this year. So I don't know if anybody did.
Don't blame me, coach.
Yeah, because it might be worth a little bit of a dive just kind of see because – but I am well familiar with Monty's coaching from before. Mm-hmm. And, you know, certainly in stark contrast to what we're talking about, Hurley and then those guys, like, you know, it's certainly his communication style is such, you know, would be the kind of thing that fits in an NBA, you know, arena, right? Like, he's a guy who doesn't really get angry and yell at players. That said, the fact that the relationship between him and DeAndre Ayton apparently seemed to completely just devolve into nothing. They didn't talk to each other. He couldn't figure out a way to communicate, which is, you know, when you have a starter on a team and your coach isn't able to figure out a way to talk to you, then that's a problem. I've never been overly impressed with his X's and O's to some degree. I feel like when we got to the playoffs and those Phoenix teams, I know I've, you know, done those videos and it was just like, this doesn't make sense what they're running. And if he's not controlling that, then that's not a good thing either. And if he is controlling it, then we have a problem because these are not the kind of plays you'd be running to optimally get the good shots. That said, you know, having KD is, you know, could be another thing which changes the trajectory of who, like how much control you have. So, you know, so I suspect that it had to be bad, right? Like Detroit doesn't have any pressure to win right now. There's no pressure. They let him go late. It was weird, right? Like it was not like usually like the next day after the season's over, we're gonna make some changes. That was not what happened. So something, you know, somebody might write a book. I don't know, but something was definitely very, very strange with all the how that went down. And you're right. Like having it be only 1 year and then do that in the midst of a time where they really couldn't care whether they win or not. Is strange in a way that there's got to be something that they really didn't like about, you know, either the knowledge of the coaching or his communication style, right?
Well, I don't know if you saw it came out that it wasn't a like president of basketball operations or GM decision. It was from the ownership, straight up from the ownership.
Yeah, right. remind me, is that job still open?
The coaching job?
Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
No one's been hired. Because again, the only reason why that would make sense to me is if the owner's like, they got somebody else that they're close with they want to bring in, right? Like that seems to me like the kind of thing that would happen because a lot of money to give up. But they have not replaced him with anybody. I know Kenny just got hired in Cleveland, right? Mm-hmm. So, that is weird. You're right. It is very, very strange. There's not a lot of explanation for that. But it's certainly what makes more sense to me that it wouldn't have been any of the basketball people making this decision. That at least that is consistent with what I would think in my mind how that would go. So I don't know. I really, you know, there isn't much to answer except for the fact that, like, you know, at some point when you realize maybe this guy isn't going to get us eventually where we want to go, let's move now. But again, they would have fired somebody, would have brought somebody in, they would have had that person in mind already. So it's very confusing and perhaps maybe indicative of like what's going on in Detroit overall and why they've struggled for a while.
Not to backtrack too much, but going back to the conversation, and if y'all talk about it, my apologies, but going back to JJ and Monty as well, from your perspective, how much of NBA coaching do you think is like ego management? And knowing and commanding a locker room of men? Because that's always been my biggest concern with JJ is like, I'm confident on his X's and O's abilities, but the lack of experiencing of coaching men, specifically the Lakers, specifically LeBron and AD, is like my biggest concern for him. So,
oh, absolutely. I mean, that's an awesome question. And with this, you know, here's the thing, like what I was, I guess, alluding to before, when you have a team with LeBron and AD playing, you know, where they are now, LeBron's filling up the box score, AD is still, you know, is prime, you know, a team like that should win a bunch of games, no matter what, you know what I mean? Just like with that kind of talent level, we saw them win a title, you know, with that, and they dragged the third best player on that team was KCP, probably, Caruso. Mm-hmm. Or maybe Kuzma, whatever it was, but like, you know, that typically you wouldn't think that kind of player would be the third best player on an NBA title team, bubble, whatever. So, so those guys generally, like, you know, maybe they're not as dominating as they used to be, right? Maybe they don't have the effect that they used to have on the bottom line of winning, like we thought they would. So suddenly, it's not necessarily like what the coaching is doing. That said, you're right. The managing the egos and all that stuff is really important. It's even harder on the LeBron coach team for sure. And yes, experience becomes a really big factor with that and how you deal with that. Now, I suppose because JJ had all those years, have you guys watching Clipped, by the way, the show?
No.
No. I don't know why I'm watching it. I don't even know why they made it necessarily, but I'm watching it, and I'm assuming that there's probably a lot of, you know, stuff rooted in facts. And just put your head in that mindset. He went through the Doc Rivers, CP3, DeAndre Jordan, Blake Griffin, you know, Clippers. That is probably pretty good training for at least being exposed to the kind of things he's going to have to deal with, and hard-headedness, and, you know, and guys who are not nice to each other, all that stuff. So it's possible that he could have used that in his interview process. I'm sure he did, to tell him, you know, I learned how to do that. Doc, you know, showed me how to deal with that a little bit. Although it sounds like maybe him and Doc are not, did not connect.
They didn't see out of here, nah.
Is that right? Am I making that up, or did I see something like that recently?
No, to my belief, he doesn't have the fondest relationship or opinion of Doc. I'm not sure if something like necessarily happened during his playing career, but nah, they just didn't see out of eye.
All right. And Clip is kind of, you know, it's interesting, an interesting portrait of Doc as well, which we could talk about too if you want to. But you know, because my take on how Doc coaches would not be the best way for a player like JJ to use. Like, if he's going to say, oh, I played for Doc, you know, playing for Phil, you know, even though Phil did get on players too, he definitely understood the optimal, like the notion of not having to just call out players all the time, not having to ride them and scream and yell at them, because he was a player who had dealt with some of that stuff when he was growing up. It looks to me like Doc is the old school version of all of that, where he'd use personal attacks in the practices and anger and just all those suboptimal things.
That's in the show.
That's in the show. Oh, you didn't see the clip? Yeah.
There's that clip in the practice where he's yelling at
everybody. Yeah, he yelled at Matt Barnes and said, "That's why." Damn. He was "That's why someone's sleeping with your wife." He was he told CP3, "Check it up. You don't know how to check. That's why you don't got no ring like LeBron. You want to have a ring like your friend. That's why you don't got one." All types of crazy stuff.
Yeah. I mean, and listen, like, if I was a writer, so when you go to like film school or whatever, I used to write screenplays. It's like you're trying to find drama and you're trying to heighten the drama, right? Even if it doesn't happen in real life, that's what you have to do. That's why it's a movie or a film or a TV show. So they could be, you know, heightening all this stuff and making it up. That said, if we remember what happened with Ben Simmons when he was trying to come back with the Sixers, and he clearly was just not into it. He was struggling. He was off to the side. You know, he wasn't really participating in the practice. And Doc saw this and said, well, I'm going to throw him in this drill. And I know, or if he didn't know, he should have known, he's probably going to kind of be half-hearted into it, not really warmed up, whatever it is, and not doing it hard. And so then that gave him the opportunity to detonate all over him and kick him out of practice and make this big show where – what was the goal? Like, what – Doc didn't really like, what was your goal? You knew that was going to happen. And so are you doing it just for yourself, for your ego, to, like, show everybody else, oh, I'm in charge here, whatever, because – anybody who understood, even from a distance, what was going on with Ben Simmons knew that if you're going to try to just shove him into a drill where he's not, like, you know, he's not really participating in the practice, and then like ride him and, you know, demand him, you got to go harder and harder, like that's going to end up bad, you know, and that's not a good result no matter how you slice it. So knowing that that kind of stuff was happening makes it pretty clear in my mind that whatever they're covering in the Clips show was probably closer to reality than not. And again, it's crazy because the coaches from that era, Doc's era, not that much older than me. He's probably 10 years older than me. You know, they learned a certain way, and man, it's hard to get them to evolve to something more optimal.
We can move on to Doc, because how we met, I know you may not remember, but I was defending Doc Rivers and combating a video that you had said. I want to apologize. Because after this season, I got to take it all back. I got to take all the defense back. Do you have a guesstimation of what could have happened in Milwaukee this season? Yeah. I mean, they truly dropped not the ball, not the baby. They dropped everything that they've had with this past like year. When it comes to coaching specifically,
well, I gotta tell you, he might be really happy, or was the happiest person to see the injuries happen to the team, because it kind of gives him an out, right? With you know, and as it should, like Giannis went down, like they're not winning anything without him playing. But you know, if you wanted to compare, like they were in first place, Adrian Griffin was, you know, coaching whatever, and then, you know, summarily dismissed. That was all very strange. Remember when Michael Jordan came back for the sixth championship You probably don't because this is before you're born. But speaking of Michael, like he said for that 1997-98 year, he's like, I'm not coming back if Phil doesn't come back. Mm-hmm. Okay. He recognized that Phil was really important to the winning, and he understood that they needed him as part of that, right? Cut to when Kobe or when the Lakers got rid of Phil the first time after when they lost that attempt at a fourth peat with Karl Malone and Gary Payton and stuff. Remember, Tom Janovich coached for like a year maybe, and then they demanded Phil come back. They needed Phil. They recognized the triangle, all that stuff was really important. So, you know, whether Giannis said fire this guy or he simply didn't say you better keep Adrian Griffin, you know, those are probably two of the same things. And so for them to fire him when they're in first place and everything was going okay, and I did the video on that, was really, really strange. And then on top of that, they had Doc Rivers consulting with the team for the month before that. Now, if you were a coach like Doc and the owner asked you to come in and consult, I don't know. I think if you polled NBA coaches across the board, you probably would have a significant number tell you that they wouldn't do it, right? Yeah. I'm not going to go and, you know, and overlook on the shoulder because also, guess what? It looks like I'm looking for his job.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like in Ukraine, right? Ukraine was so afraid that Russia was going to invade that they were talking about joining NATO. And then Russia invaded. Like, so that way, but then the Russian wants to pretend that it was because they were going to join NATO when it was actually the other way around. They were afraid that Russia was going to do it. So to not put the politics in here, it's kind of the same idea where it's like, you know, Doc is going to consult. And either way, it looks like he wants that job, and then he gets the job. So, what was that about? And the worst part about it was that they were playing fine; they're playing well. It looked like I did the video where it was like the only thing they wanted to change was how they played their defense, their coverage of defense, and with Brook Lopez primarily. And they wanted him to come up a little bit higher and not drop so much because Budenholzer had him dropping so far and so ridiculously far, and then it would kill him in the playoffs. And And so it seemed like that frustration was what kind of started the conversation against Adrian Griffin, who, by the way, isn't one of those nice guys. He ain't going to yell at anybody and getting, you know, really detonated as far as I could tell. The only thing that made a little bit of a raised eyebrow would be that Terry Stotts was fired right before the season started. Now, the other thing is people might not realize, I don't know exactly how much influence head coaches have on the assistant coaches, believe it or not. I think a lot of times the management brings them in and they say, okay, well, I'll make it work, right? And so it's unclear if Adrian Griffin was the one who had Stotts join him. And then it's also a little bit strange to me that Griffin could have that much, say to say he needs to be fired. That's not right. Stotts left.
Yeah, right? He resigned. I was about to say, I thought that he resigned. Right,
right. That is right. So as a result, it wasn't – Griffin didn't have that power. I don't think he would have had the power to say you got to fire him because I don't think he had hired him in the first place. So that was weird, but he might have already been feeling a little bit threatened about that because, again, if I'm a coach in the NBA, a head coach, the last thing I'd want is probably a guy who's already been a head coach as my assistant because ownership would easily say, oh, we can get rid of him because we got somebody else who's there. He's got experience. Let's just replace him. Now, it's probably not realistic to expect that they wouldn't put somebody with experience next to Adrian Griffin, but I would have been worried about that myself, especially now that Dame joined the team, right? And now, Stotts has coached Dame before, and they've coached him to good success. So all of that was probably mixed in there, but the bottom line is it was very, very strange that it would, from my estimation, at least from X's and O's, it was literally about where they wanted Brook Lopez guarding, on the floor, and that was enough, even though they were still winning and in the first place. Very, very strange.
Yeah, I didn't like the optics, and it starts this carousel. I've been floating out this theory of a carousel. You fire one coach because, you know, you don't get, I guess, the desired results every single time. I understand the problem with Bud, but I think they overreacted. But cool. Now you're starting this carousel as opposed to pointing to, you know, who the actual culprits are in the situation. And it damages like continuity. And so then you bring in Doc Rivers, who, for whatever reason, I feel like it was maybe around that time or it was after he got the job, started to get on these podcasts and give himself so many excuses as to why he wasn't in the wrong.
That's when JJ got mad.
Yeah, that's when JJ got mad. There was no coaching, not in Boston, not in Orlando, not in Los Angeles. And I would think that ownership would kind of look at that and be like, ah, man, this is a guy who probably shouldn't be around here for too long.
Yeah, I mean, I would think that, you know, the other guys who are always have a girlfriend, you know, like they can't not have a girlfriend. It's like he has to have a job. Like he lost the Clippers job and then was like in Philly within 2 hours. And like, you know what I mean? It was weird. He might be okay. He should just relax a little bit, you know, do the TV thing for a year at least, you know, without all that stuff. It's like that would be my suggestion. But that said, like, you know, in that video that where we first connected, it was like, you know, I've got actually kind of gotten back and forth on that myself. Because you're right, like there is a whole thing about like if it's the player's fault, is it his fault? You know, if there was enough, I guess the point I was making in the video was sort of like there is enough, of a pattern here of how his teams end up sort of falling apart. And we have, you know, even more evidence now that at some point you got to kind of maybe start thinking that maybe it's the bench and what his effect was. I mean, it certainly what rubbed me wrong for the Clippers run for so long was that with the guys like CP3 who can get hot headed. I don't know what the word, you know, he loses mind sometimes and just take himself out of the games. To add a coach who couldn't sort of relax about the refereeing calls all the time, it just created a really bad mix. And that's not like that wouldn't have been the optimal way to coach that team, which was a terrific team and probably, you know, should have. They had a 3-1 lead heading into the Western Conference Finals, right, against Houston. And man, like it was brutal to watch. And you could see the anxiety grow across the bench for everybody. And, you know, then you see other coaches who don't exhibit that kind of anxiety inducing behavior visually. And they don't melt. They don't melt down. Even the thing like, listen, Jock's got a really bad back problem, right? So he has to bend over. You ever see this when he's always like bent over on the bench for like stretches? You haven't seen him do this?
No.
I've been doing it for years. It's like he's like this. He's literally
did it start?
He's like this.
Oh, I kind of. Damn, I thought he was just tired.
Game planning.
No. Well,
thought he was thinking. Way, thinking, bro.
It's for a big part of the game. I got to tell you, that's really bad body language. I had a lunch today talking to another coach about it, where it's like, if you have that much trouble, you just have to sit down. You know, don't be bent over staring at the ground because it looks like you're so disappointed in your players that they're like they're playing so bad that that you know it's not even worth looking at them. You know what I mean?
A back problem. I thought he was trying to get like a better angle of the spacing on the.
Y'all
court.
Thought that was his hands in his pockets? Y'all thought that was his Darvin Ham?
Yeah. Think about that. And so Darvin Ham sitting at home because his hands are in his damn pocket, which by the way is another one of those. You know, negative body language things like your hands in your pockets, or, you know, arms folded is another one.
It was the problem.
You know,
I thought that was his LeBron, like game 6. I'm locked in. I swear to you.
No, that was his back hurt. My back is killing me from trying to coach. This pressure is so immense. I need help.
I'm literally folding.
He's hunched over at the scorer's table.
You know, it really is. I wish I could laugh as hard as you guys. It's so frustrating to me because, well, listen, one of the things I try and do is help coaches understand how important all that body language is, right? It really, you know, I remember a ref in a summer league game when I was coaching in high school in 1990, whatever it was, telling me about that. I got to work my body language. And I remember being so dismissive of it. And I like, man, have I come all the way around and realized what it was. Although I had a funny line to him. I said, well, let me ask you this. Based on my body language, do you know how I feel about your calls? And he goes, yeah. I'm like, good. So, but that wasn't, you know, and that another problem. Okay, if I'm mad about the calls and I'm expressing that, well, my players might not realize that. They might not be able to discern between that I'm thinking about the ref versus what they play. And these are younger guys. That could have a big effect. So anyway, it's crazy. It's crazy how this is going. And I don't anticipate Doc getting much more out of this from the Bucks than what we saw anyway. Because I think that they weren't going to go that far in the playoffs as it was. You know, they did not play well at all after Doc took over at all.
Yeah.
You know, and so, he's one of those guys like for a while there. Remember in the NBA, maybe, you know, it was a while ago, they used to just retread coaches, right? Like Bill Fitch would just constantly be getting hired and hired because he had experience, but not if he was a good coach or not. And Doc is somewhat in that same line here. I think he, you know, he probably would end up being a much better, you know, commentator now. Let him do that. Like, I think he'd be good at that. But here we are. And I don't anticipate that the Bucks finding the success we're looking for, which is a championship with him.
Yeah, no, I agree. The only thing I would say is I feel like the NBA is coming around the time where they are trying out new coaches, building through the G League, you know, as we've seen through like OKC with their coach. They're trying different approaches. I know some of the like Tom Thibodeau's of the world are still kicking around, but the idea of Avery Johnson and Mark Jackson getting skipped around and Loy Pierce, you gotta do your due diligence.
Now you want to talk about the pop tree.
Yeah. And I was actually looking at the tree that Adrian Griffin and them came from. But I actually do want to go to a newer coach.
I mean, it's Budenholzer, it's Monty.
Yeah, I know. I wanna go to a newer coach that actually just won a title. I know that on the court it definitely didn't look good for the Mavericks and a lot of these games. But I tuned into the video that you did with AC, and you guys were talking about coaching. So from your perspective, how bad did Jason Kidd get outcoached by Joe Mazzulla in this finals?
I would say he got outcoached to the point of it should have at least gone six games, if not seven. And at that point, you know, listen, Boston was great. They were a historically great team throughout the whole regular season. So, you know, I doubted them. I thought the Mavericks were going to be able to win, but I didn't also assume that KP was going to come back the way he did in the first game. And remember, like, if that doesn't happen, then maybe they don't win the first game or they change everything. And, the second game was down on the wire. It was close. So but the bottom line is it was really like the offense. Right. Amazingly enough, the Celtics offense did not do as well as it had done in the previous rounds. And, you know, even though Luka was getting, you know, blown by and whatever, they were doing some things that were pretty good. Jason Kidd was on the defensive end that was able to hold them, you know, lower an offensive ratings than they had in the previous rounds. But offensively for the Mavericks, it was really, really frustrating to watch where they just didn't understand how to attack what the Celtics were doing. You know, they wanted to attack Al Horford in the pick and roll, but then they put Al Horford on Derrick Jones Jr. So that means Derrick Jones Jr. needs to come set the ball screen, and that screws up their entire balance of the floor because they wanted it to have a centered Gafford set the ball screen, right? And they had Tatum on Gafford. So there were these inklings that they were slowly starting to figure out over time that were going to work and be able to really destroy that line, that matchup going down to Gafford in the post. They did it like four times in the five games. And I think he scored on three or four of them or something like that. So, and then maybe he kicked out for a three and another. So it was like, that's what you need to do more of. And not even a lot more of, but just a little bit more of. And then that would force Mazzulla to actually, you know, maybe guard them in a more traditional way. And then they can go back to trying to do the ball screen stuff. Now, they also took him three games to figure out that if they switch. The other thing that was interesting was, so as Horford's man was coming up to set the ball screen, if you can picture this, Derek White would quickly jump in there and get Horford back so Horford doesn't have to be involved in the pick and roll. So now Horford's guarding somebody else. It took him three games to figure out, wait a minute, maybe we'll send that new guy that Horford's guarding up as a second ball screener, and then Luka can go at him. And they finally did that, but like so far in a few between that it didn't give them an advantage they could have had. So, yeah, like that was a big problem. And again, it was that kid. I have to say it's kid because kid should be telling, you know, Luka what he should be doing. And they weren't doing that at all. And they were playing right into the Celtics' hands. There was no movement before the ball screen. So they were able to pre-switch all those screens and not give up any advantage. So, yeah. Now, that said, Luka was probably 60%, 70%, whatever he was. So yeah. That's part of it, too. It really is a little bit unfair on that end, but they could have at least still given him a little bit more support from the bench they didn't do offensively.
I think Jason Kidd has grown, though, as a coach over the years from Brooklyn to Milwaukee to even his time. When he got hired in Dallas, I was a little concerned, but he's shown that he has grown. So I think he can take from this. Hopefully the organization can also, you know, make a few roster changes and stuff like that. I know the price of the price of free agents are like through the roof. The price for trades are through the roof right now. But, you know, maybe they can make some changes and then be back in the conversation next year. That's at least what I'm hoping.
Absolutely. Like, yeah, from where he started with Brooklyn till now, for sure. I hadn't felt like there was a lot of gaps that were going on, like coaching problems. And he's really developed that. He's got probably a better bench alongside him as assistant. So without question. And that this will definitely be a learning experience. I think that they're going to sit down there and pull this apart and figure out where they can do better. Because, you know, Luka is so good that I was so glad to get see him back in the playoffs and be able to show us what he can do when he can do it. So there's no question. Yeah, that'll help him. And then, but speaking of like that, Mazzulla, like I've gone a 360. I've done 720 on him now as far as what I felt like he was doing last year to this year. Really, really just next level stuff. You know, Sam Cassell on his bench. Like, here's another guy. Why doesn't he ever get interviewed for head coaching jobs? You know, that's interesting to me. He's been on a bunch of different great, you know, benches. So clearly that helped him. But like Mazzulla really just I've really been able to marvel at like the things that how he was doing and how he's communicating. They all responded to him and he was able to, you know, to lead them to the final. So to the championship. So, yeah, it happens. The same thing could happen with Kidd.
Going back to Kidd, though, do you have any doubt? As far as like a heliocentric offense being a winning formula for a championship winning team, because obviously there's been so many cases of heliocentric offenses being successful in the league. Obviously the Suns, James Harden's Rockets, even the Mavs, you know, they just made it to the finals. But in terms of winning it all, is it like once you get to the final round or somebody's final rounds, when you're going up against more talented teams that can like take away the advantages that you would have with the heliocentric offense, do you think at the end of the day there's just too many like cons with heliocentricism? Or
I'm willing to go on record as saying if Luka was 100%, they could have won that series.
Damn.
Now here's the only problem, because here's the thing: KP doing what he did for only those few games, and even now he was injured and out for the other ones. But there was one surprise, which is what had me picking the Mavericks. The other one was Kyrie Irving turning into the worst player on the floor. I couldn't see that. And I don't know, you know, exactly what happened there, because, you know, okay, he takes tough shots, but he was making tough shots against everybody before that. Like that's not a weird thing for him. For him to completely lose that edge or whatever he had like that, you know, I mean, if he had played even average in game two, like they win that game, they should win that game, right? And like, they know 1-1 changes the complexion of the series. So yes, I think for sure whatever Dallas is doing with Luka for sure could win a title at some point. Because remember, the other key they did, though, was they surrounded him with really good defenders. So Gafford, Jones Jr., Washington, who am I missing? You know, Green coming off the bench. You know, that was important, too, to find those 3-and-D kind of guys. So all of that mixed together, yes, to me, was on the right track. And I think they could definitely do that with at least with what Dallas is doing. Is there any other example right now of Helio?
In terms of in the NBA?
Yeah. Anybody else now doing it? Because Harden is not doing
the
it
Knicks
anymore.
As a heliocentric?
Oh, yeah. Gosh.
But that might be due to this. That might be due to injury, though. That might be not the fairest of judges.
Denver? Okay. Right.
Not Denver. Phoenix.
Well, but they got the three, and so they're never quite like what we're seeing in Dallas, right? Heliocentric almost has to be like there's a minimum usage percentage they have to have before you can really
deem OKC.
OKC could be closest, right? And that's kind of the reason why like Giddy couldn't really function really well with them, because he needed the ball too to be able to do some nice passes and stuff like that. So you know, but I think you could probably do it if you were able to have a really, really imposing defense, right? That's the whole key in my mind. If you can really like cause problems and shut guys down defensively, then yes, the offense could work for sure.
Yeah, not fair. My biggest concern is just, before Damo goes, my bad, it's just the lack of a balanced attack. with a heliocentric offense.
And by the way,
a little bit too predictable.
And as a coach, you're right. Like, I would hate to see that, right? I love to see the ball movement and player movement and cutting and all that stuff. I just did a video on how Mikal Bridges is going to fit in, which, by the way, also connects to the conversation about coaching, because most coaches, I think, will tell you now in the NBA, they don't have practices. They don't have time to have 2-hour practices and an off day where they're running up and down and drills and all that stuff. So, you know, you need – the reason why the Knicks are going to have a big advantage now is they're bringing in another guy that's completely familiar with the other three, and you probably don't need a lot of reps in practice to get them on the same page. And so that's going to be a big advantage, I think, for the Knicks going forward. So the Celtics are going to have their hands full, I think, going forward. The only thing is if Hartenstein doesn't return, which I don't think he will, that's gonna be a one. That's too bad. He is one of those X factors, I think, for the Knicks. And if they could figure out how to keep him. I had an idea about that, by the way. So I believe because they only signed into a 2-year contract, they only have his limited bird rights and not his full bird rights. So they can only offer him, I think it was like $16.5 million per year. And he's probably going to get an offer of 20, 21. And he's got to take it. Like, if he doesn't take it, his agents should fire him. So why couldn't they do something where they're like, okay, we'll pay you $16.5 million, but we're going to find you $5 million of endorsements that will make up the difference. And they find those that maybe they even pay for them, you know, in a laundered money kind of way. Why couldn't they do that? You know, in the land of NIL and everything that's going on.
It makes sense. They need to, because right, I think that they have like the biggest, best shot. They sold out to get Mikal. They sold out to get OG. You know, they really put the farm on the table and gave everybody everything. They have to figure out a way to bring it back. They would probably be one of the more the bigger questionable modern day teams as to, you know, like what if they were healthy versus the Celtics and
well, by the way, they need to trade Randall, right? Yeah, Randall needs to go, and that's absolutely a huge contract that gets off their books. But again, because of these limited bird rights, it doesn't mean they can offer that extra money to Hartenstein, which really is like it sucks. All they had to do is offer him a 3-year contract. That's the dumb thing about all of that, right? He was so cheap, nobody was going to sign him. They could have signed him for whatever they wanted to, and they could have given him a 3-year deal. They should have done that, and that would have eliminated. He'd still be on contract for more year. Like, it seems silly. So that was the small sided part of it. Cause like, would it really have killed them, to go into this next year? They would have been paying him whatever he's paying, like $10 million a year this year, whatever it was. And it would be nothing for a starter on a good team. It'd be insane. They'd have a great deal. So that's also on them. And they're not going to be able to replace him. Now you put Mitchell Robinson in the lineup and it changes everything because he's not the offensive person that, Hartenstein is, unfortunately. And so, you know, they're good, and he on the defensive end, he's good. But, you know, you need great on both ends.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What were you going to ask?
I was going to ask another Mavericks question. So it brought up the offense, them being heliocentric as probably a issue for them going forward. I was going to say defensively, you did bring up that they surrounded Luka with better defenders, but you couldn't tell watching that finals with that. Well, to me, look like defensive schemes and adjustments. I could not get away from the fact that every time I looked on the court, the corners is wide open for the Celtics. They were a pass away from an open corner three from anybody. Deadly shooter, Xavier Tillman, whatever it was. Was I just noticing something dumb? Was that like a coaching scheme or something that should have been changed? Is it a pick your poison with how the Celtics are doing their offense? They run a 5-out.
Okay. One thing is, and I'm doing this video as well in the middle of trying to get that done with everything else, but, you know, the Celtics are kind of changing the way the game is going to be played going forward with 5 elite 3-point shooters on the floor, right? That changes a lot of different things in terms of spacing and how you have to defend it. What I liked that the Mavericks were doing was for Kyrie, they were keeping him out of guarding anybody in the corners. Okay. So whenever his man would go to the corner, he would just stay up on the wing, and then the big man would be the guy guarding the corner. So, and primarily because normally if he's on the weak side and there's penetration, it's that position that has to come over and rotate. And if it's a guard, then it doesn't help you. And Kyrie ain't going to help you really. Maybe he'll get a steal once every 3 games. So it makes sense to have the center there. But that means that Kyrie's going to be the guy who has to X out to the corner if it gets kicked out to that far. Now, they got away with it a little bit because I don't think the Celtics did a great job of skipping to the corners when you saw those openings, right? But what they did have a problem with is on the, when you're helping from on the strong side. So if the ball is on your side and you're guarding the corner and then it comes and you help off there, it's an easy pass a high schooler can make and an easy shot a high schooler can make, right? And that's what we try to do, you know, never do that. Now, the Tillman three that he did get, I don't think Tillman had shot a three in a month or two. So I get it. Like, let him shoot it, stare him, and he made it. Mm-hmm. But then we saw it happen against, like, off of Jaylen Brown or somebody, and I think that was Kyrie too. So there's a lack of discipline defensively that they didn't have. You know, I know that awful coaching who came on the show. Do you know that guy who screams and yells?
Yes.
He has a lot of misguided takes on defense, but he was pointing out some stuff too, where like it just looked like they weren't drilling this stuff, and maybe they weren't. I don't know. But Kyrie let him down on that end as well, and so that's an interesting question because if he's going to be like in a fog on both ends of the floor. Yeah, then you have a problem. You have to limit his minutes, you know what I mean? And then that means Luka's got to play more. So, oh, and plus, they didn't do a good job of protecting Luka. So just like Horford was being protected a lot of the time, and KP as well, for not having to get up in that pick and roll, they weren't doing the same thing with Luka. And so he was getting caught out there on an island, you know, guarding a ball handler coming around a ball screen. And you could just tell, I mean, he's not like a great defender a lot of times, but there are moments when he can move. And there were times he just wouldn't, I think he was hurt. His knee was bleeding, you know, he's draining his knee every game. Yeah. So I think that was a big factor too. That would have been a little different if he was, you know, 80, 90%.
Yeah. He definitely wasn't as bad as he showed in the finals. His foot looked like it was almost nailed to the ground on a lot of these possessions. Kind of rounding it out with these last couple questions. So you actually brought up my biggest takeaway from the NBA Finals is that I believe that the Celtics have unlocked the key, at least the first step, to revolutionizing how teams are created now. I don't know if you've looked. I'm an Atlanta fan. Have you looked at Richey's film at all yet?
Complete revelation to me. I hadn't even realized he was on the board, much less going to get drafted. So you tell me. I'm derelict in my duty. What is he? What kind of player is he?
I think what a lot of us thought is that we saw what happened with Luka and Derek Lively last year, right? He was, I mean, just the thing that they needed, a breath of fresh air, a lob threat just for him. And pairing Ausar with a Trey was supposed to be, you know, what that was supposed to be 2.0 right there. That's the next one that's going to get it done. Richey for me wasn't even on my board. Like you said, he wasn't in my scope either. He is at best Harrison Barnes. I don't want to be, you know, and look at you. Harrison Barnes at one is kind of crazy. Yeah. He supposedly has some ability to put it on the floor, but he's a weaker guy. The handle isn't like the best. He can shoot it. He can shoot it. I mean, that's he can shoot it. And then also he's corner. Yeah, from the
Oh, okay.
He's a below the break shooter. Let's just say that
he can shoot the basketball.
PJ Washington shooter.
And then also they're projecting that the defensive upside, especially because of the length, is going to be there. Now again, not even close to NBA strength. Like, you know, very. But you know, he's a 19-year-old kid or whatever the case may be. But with that being said, with the limited knowledge that you may have on Richey, do you think that the Hawks went in that direction because, like we were talking about, the future of what NBA basketball is, a Trae Young who can drive, shoot, pass, DeJounte Murray who can drive, shoot, pass, Jalen Johnson, Richey, and then you just have to find that five that kind of just works.
Yeah, I mean, listen, the guy that should be drafted number one in every draft should be Kevin Durant. Like, that is who you're trying to get, in my mind. A guy who's long, he can guard, he can play defense, he can shoot threes, and maybe put the ball on the ground. I would just take the shooting at this point. If you're a shooter and you can play defense and you got length, that's all you want. When did DeAndre Ayton get drafted number one? Not that long ago, right? 2019? 2018? Like, when he was – listen, I like Ayton. I think he got – and he got better defensively, and he was – you know, it could have been a good piece on a team that would have gone far. That's not the guy you should be drafting number one anymore. It would have been in 1990, but not anymore. So they got to get off because you could have gotten him at 10. You know what I mean? Like that's a guy who you don't want to waste number one pick on. So yes, I think going forward, and by the way, the KD guy you want is going to be your center in 5 years, right? So OG is going to play center. Like I, like when the Knicks play Mikal Bridges and him together without a center, that's going to be the center, or either OG or Bridges. One of those two guys is going to end up playing the biggest guy on the other side. And it's going to force the other team to go small, because the other, if they go big, that guy is going to get run off the court. So, yes, that is the future, is both five elite three-point shooters, and probably a lot of time spent with your tallest guy is going to be that 6'8", 6'9", guy with a lot with long arms who can really defend and shoot. So, yeah. And once you have that, right, that changes everything, because with Lively, you know, it's very traditional, and the Celtics are able to show how they can stay at home on the role guy and sort of take away the role and force Luka to kind of have to be the guy who shoots it all the time. And that was a problem. Like that was not working very well. Now, if Luka again was closer to 100%, it would have been better, and they would have gotten six games at least, I think. But yeah, that is the future of the game without question. And so I think it'll get smaller and smaller. Now smaller could be Wembanyama, you know, at 7'5", but like thin and long and guard like skills. And you know, thank God the Spurs didn't like park his ass on the block and tell him to post up 10 times a game. So yeah, but that said, I'm also the guy who's like, guards need to post up more. Like those are the guys who should be down there posting up and let the bigs, you know, space the floor and shoot threes. So yeah, so I think we're in. And by the way, that could also cause a lot of problems. You've seen people lament, I don't watch the game anymore. Right, you hear that a lot. I see it on Twitter all the time. Anymore, mm-hmm. because they watched it a lot. They love it from. I'm watching a game from 88. There's no way anybody would ever want the kind of game that they're playing now. There's no way. This is not basketball the way we want it to. It's six, seven guys in the lane, the whole possession. It's horrible. The refereeing was not how we ever wanted the ball to be refereed. But we had this weird nostalgic, you know, pining for a day that's gone by that was never what they thought it was in the first place. So the point thing is that, you know, 5 years from now, the game will probably not be that recognizable to what it was 5 years ago. And they're going to run the real risk of, you know, losing audience because it isn't what they thought it was or they used to do or they grew up with. And they're going to have to somehow, you know, bridge this and somehow bring everybody along with this so we can stick with it. Otherwise, you'll have to find a whole new set of fans.
Yeah. And I could see that's why the Hawks went that way, too. I'm trying to come around to it, especially because OG's going for what he went for. To get a Mikal, you've basically got to leverage your entire future for first. That's, I mean, that's a lot. Well, five first, wasn't it? Because they had the protected
four unprotected one and then one protected.
Yeah,
completely unprotected.
Yeah,
four completely unprotected picks, first round picks.
Wow. I mean, after the Kyrie pick that or what turned into Kyrie, because the Clippers sent it to the Cleveland. I thought you'd never, ever see another pick go unprotected to another team. And I don't think it really had until now. That's a mistake, I would think. They, you know, how hard would it have been to place a little protection on that top five, top four, something, right? Let's not forget, I think what the draft is just a complete crapshoot, right? You know, there are a couple teams that seem to be able to figure it out a little bit and have consistency, but man, you know, 80% of these picks are like, you know, I don't know. We're lucky that we got this. And, you know, look how many second round draft picks are now all-stars. I saw something like that, right, where there's like a whole lot of – they're mining that down there. Jokic, for instance, was a second round pick, right? So, you know, that's the question. By the way, and Jokic, it sort of flies in the face of what we're talking about going forward about what you want in the NBA player. And he's a guy who's a reigning MVP and all that stuff. You know, so there still is room. Listen, there's still room for a team to send two bigs to the offensive glass every time, you know. And I still think you could probably do that, even though nobody wants to do that. They're so afraid of getting beat back in transition. But it's a copycat league. The Celtics just won, and that's what everyone's going to be trying to move towards. And it's going to change the game, and it's going to change the way they defend, because the way they're pre-switching those pick and rolls and then switching them all – kind of negates the pick and roll to some degree, right? So that might mean that offenses are going to stop running a pick and roll as much, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but it's just going to be way different in my mind. And again, will the majority of the fans go along with that?
It is interesting that you brought up like the evolution point of like OG being a five in the future, because I actually have the same theory as you, but like a different result in terms of, I just feel like the name of the game moving forward is trying to find a guard in every position, but also trying to find the tallest guard as you can. You know what I'm saying? So if you can get a 7'5" dude with the guard-like skills, in every position, I feel like that would be the ideal makeup. Obviously, that's the most extreme.
Five Wendy's is crazy.
But ideally, if we're talking about the most ideal sense, that is how you would want to play the game. But I think in 5-6 years, I think the minimum for a point guard is going to be like 6'4", 6'5". I'm being honest.
But Pat Riley called it. He goes, "I want 5 Magic Johnsons." Yeah. That was the ideal team. And, the reason is because when you have guys like, Derrick Jones Jr., who are so limited offensively, and you load up on Luka and you load up on Kyrie, you can do that. You can load up on both of them in the same possession. It's going to get kicked with a major advantage to him. And he can't take advantage of that. That's what's going to kill you. And you got to be able to have that, at least as a third or fourth guy. PJ Washington did it a little bit, but not, it's a little shaky on that end. Lively and those guys are not going to be creating off the dribble. Even Gafford wouldn't. So it's an interesting thing where you hope the bigger players will continue to get guard-like skills. I think we're going to get there. I think for a long time, like Kevin Durant's lucky in some degree. He was in that crossroads where a few years before that, they would have forced Durant to eat chicken and pasta all day long and marked his butt on the post and said, "You go down there, we're going to throw it down to you," right? But he was lucky that he somehow avoided that part of it in Texas and then became a guard, basically, at 7 feet. And that was the sort of the turning point, I think. So we'll continue to see that for sure. But again, you have to remember, when I was growing up, man, if you had any size, you would not be allowed to have guard skills. Even if you had them, you wouldn't be allowed to display them. It was really frustrating.
Yeah.
Last question I have for you. You're the basketball hot topic-y trend. We're done with the 90s. You got awful coaching. We talked about it a little bit before we started hitting record. Are there any legs to the fake defensive player of the year for Michael Jordan?
So, okay, full disclosure, I grew up in Chicago. I'm a Bulls fan from 1978 to 1998. I was at all those games. We had tickets. I went to all those games from Michael's second year on, okay? And so I know that Michael Jordan deserved the Defensive Player of the Year award that year, and he deserved it probably more other times as well. I know that Michael Jordan played lockdown defense a lot of the time. And especially when he got focused and you challenged him, it was game over. Like, he was going to take it upon himself to do that and impose his will on you on the defensive end as much as he would trying to dunk on you on the other end. So it's a little bit weird to have to deal with this, because part of the thing is, okay, great, they inflated his defensive numbers at home. They did, fine. Everybody was inflated. And they were doing it to everybody, right? Stockton's assists probably are like way inflated, right? But whatever. So there is – now, I think Haberstroh's point was that they were inflated even more than normal. But okay, fine. I've already started going through one of the games. It's going to take a while. I got to watch every possession. I found 5 or 6 instances of him literally just locking down the guy. He can't get by him on the dribble. Then the next time they're trying to set a ball screen, he's not being screened. He refuses. He boxes out big guys. He's doing all the things you'd want to see from a guard and more. He's like helping, and trying to reach and stunt and get around and then block shots when he knows. Back then, he had an advantage because when the ball went down to the post, they didn't kick it out for threes. That wasn't happening. They were doing a post move. They were going to score. So he was taking advantage of that by coming and swooping in from behind and knocking those balls, or trying to as much as he could. I know that if they had started to sort of fake and then kick it back out to his man for threes or open shots, he would have had to adjust it, but they didn't do that. Back then, it wasn't the mindset. You didn't drive in the middle back then and then throw the ball out to a corner three. Like, that was insane. They'd say, you're in the basket. Why would you, you're 12 feet away. Why would you now throw it to 20 feet away? That doesn't make sense. When in fact, what it makes sense is a contested 12-foot in the air runner over a 7-footer, the expected percentage is a lot lower than what it would be on an open three in the corner. It took coaches years to figure that one out. In fact, when I was in high school in the late 80s, geez, I would try play this way. And I had a constant pull with my coach and then even my players, I would drive and I'm trying to kick and they just stand there. They wouldn't replace. So like where the open area was, because their man was looking at me and my guy wanted to pass, who was behind. All I had to do is lift. So I get stuck in the air, couldn't pass it to him because it'd be a turnover. It was horrible, right? So I can remember even back then having some notion of like what this could be. And yet they just resisted for all that time. So to answer your question, and there's a long version and maybe not to get it a little more concise, it's silly. It's, what he did defensively was utterly deserving of a Defensive Player of the Year award and more. And he continued that excellence all the way through the 90s as well. I don't think he ever really, declined defensively like we've seen some other players.
I agree, Coach. I agree.
I'm not talking about LeBron specifically right now.
Okay. I was about to say. Okay, so do you think today that they boost people's numbers, or do you think that was they stopped that at some point?
So one of my buddies, Chip, who's come on the show, does stats for the Magic as well, and he told me that it's all vetted. They go through the games later too, and they make sure through the video that it's accurate, because you know, jerks like me are going to call them out when we find that out. In fact, that happened once years ago. I think Russ had 20 assists or something like that. They made a big deal about it, and I was doing the game because of course you had to break down that game, and there were only 19. There were not 20. And I did a thing on Twitter, and and they changed it. Like, I don't know if I had that effect, but like that would have an effect now if somebody started coming out, and they will. I'm sure they're going to find that out a little bit. But as far as I can tell, you can't really get away with it now because we all have access to all the games and the play-by-play. We could check it with one click. So I would say that this is now an era where it's much more accurate,
especially with sports betting. Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
You can't do that. Oh my.
Yeah, well, wait, it's not betting. It's daily fantasy. We can't call it betting. Can we? Maybe we can. I don't know. But daily fantasy. Believe me, I tried doing that. I have a sponsor, and God darn it, like, you know, trying to win those things is so hard. They have that algorithm dialed in really well, right? But when it hits, though, it's fun. It certainly makes the game a lot more interesting. I'll say that.
Yeah.
Man. And but also, yeah, anyway, I won't go into the more of that, but anyway, yeah, use my code, whatever. yeah, no, it's remarkable actually because of all the how accurate I think those are. They could figure out the algorithm for that, but yeah, we won't. I don't think we're going to see anybody with the blown up numbers. That said, the assist thing is a real thing, right? Like, and I just saw one in today's game from last year or whatever, where a guy caught the ball in the backcourt, took four dribbles and then a move and pull up, and the guy who passed it to him in the backcourt got the assist. So there's the problem here, and that's being vetted. Like, that goes to Secaucus and they say, yeah, it's an assist. Like, something is going on here. They're not defining it properly for that. Everything else would be probably rock solid.
Dang. I thought you were going to really shock the world and say, yeah, I was there. They faked those steals.
I didn't see him.
They did. They did. They gave him more steals than he had. They gave him a few more blocks. You know. Okay.
It just doesn't change anything for you. It just doesn't.
Right. Because like, are you bringing it up because you want to make it seem like he didn't deserve that award? And you know, even Bob Ryan, who was quoted in that piece, was like, I didn't look at the numbers. I just knew I saw it, and like everybody saw it. You know. And that's good. And they might even realize then that they were inflated. I don't know, but we didn't hear about that. I think no one was really aware of it too much. Even though the assist thing I think was in my mind even back then, but not the steals and blocks. But the point of it is was he a great defender? Was he probably one of the greatest defenders at that position? Yeah, he really was. Like, I think that, like, there's, you know, as time goes by and other people's legacies are get on the line, people want to rewrite that. But I was there. I saw it in person. I've seen the other guys in person and live. I can tell you right now that, in my book, no one played better than that.
Yeah, cook.
Nah,
isn't that controversial? Everybody else wants to say that, you know, Michael was a fraud or whatever, right? That's what they want to say. So I feel like I'm now controversial trying to tell you that he wasn't.
I mean, I just feel like if finding out his stats were inflated is now changing your perception of Michael Jordan as a defender, then again, like what you said, you just didn't watch him play. And even if it went down from 3.3 to 2.4, is that 0.8? Like, I don't think that's still a guy that got a lot of steals a game.
Changes everything.
Yeah, he was everywhere. He was everywhere on the court, and because he was determined to win it, so he was doing everything he could. And you know, we don't see players like that. Like, by the way, did he get beat? Yeah. Did he give up a layup on one? Yeah. Did he get beat? Like, he didn't get around a pin down. And that's the other thing that's interesting about defending back then. Offense again. No one should ever have to play offense like that. Three out, two in. Whenever you caught the ball on the wing, there was always a guy posting up in front of you. You had never had a chance to like break your man down and drive the basket. It was insane. So defensively, with that in mind as well, it changed the way you defended because you were basically going around pin downs the whole time. like for Michael, his position. So he just had to navigate a pin down every other possession, right? Knowing that if he gets on the guy, behind him is a guy posting up. So he's not necessarily in a position all the time, hardly ever, where he's got a really big, well, I got to keep him in front, right? So you can argue that that was a difference which made defenders better. Oh, you know what? I didn't even realize that. This is a new thing I'm just formulating in my head right now. It arguably was easier to play defense back then because of the way they ran offense, not because of the rules. The rules, by the way, allowed you to play defense because you were much more physical, hand-checking on stuff, which was helpful. But it was also, if you're really smart about it, you know that you could pressure the ball a little bit more because there's no way for them, nowhere for them to go. They're going to run into their own man down low in the post a lot of the time. So that's fascinating to me now that I've kind of wrapped my head around that one. But again, you'll still see these moments that they try and drive in the middle. He just cuts them right off, and again, give him credit. He was smart enough to understand that innately and be able to take advantage of like the limitations. And again, I guess what I'm trying to say is this is a coaching issue. The coaches back then were so unimaginative, I suppose, in the NBA that it's on them. They didn't understand this well enough. Now, the Lakers were able to run. They ran, right? They did all the fast breaking as a way to probably avoid having to run all the offense that they sensed was suboptimal. Now, of course, Kareem in the post, you're going to give it to him a lot. But when you can get extra possessions in the fast break, that helps you, right? That gets you more opportunities to score easier shots because you know you're going to get bogged down. And then limit yourself with the spacing. So anyway, that's my whole thing. And by the way, Michael Cooper, another one of those amazing defenders who could lock down. And I know he didn't have a lot of steals or blocks the year before when he won Defensive Player of the Year. But, you know, he was a guy that could shut down at a position that was the premier scoring position. Every night you had Larry, Dominique, Dr. J. Like, it was a murderer's row back then at that position that he had to deal with. So there was no hiding. Worthy, although Worthy's on his team. But you know what I mean? Like back then, that was the position. Do we have that now? Do we have a position like that that's clear? Like that was small forward back then. Point guard. Do we have a position now?
Might say point guard. Point guard would be the lead guard if you don't even want to say point guard because a lot of guys are combo guards now. I was at a lead guard spot now. And I mean, and this is just my opinion because I mean, I'm a big man, so I'm a cape. I'm not gonna lie, man. Any given night, you don't know what you're getting at the big man spot you got to deal with. And that could be frustrating for a lot of guys who might not be the most prowess on the defensive end. If I'm a cakewalk on the defensive side of the basketball, a lot of these bigs will give me problems.
That's true. I like that. Like where you never know, right? That's probably more frustrating. It's all over the place at that position. Whereas like back then, if you're playing small forward position, you had there was no nights off. It was Adrian Dantley. It was, you know what I mean? You're going to have a 28-30 point game score to have to deal with, and they were going to go at you. So I suppose lead guard, I'm going to look right now at the points per game. So who are the top guys? It's like Luka, Giannis, Shea, Brunson, KD, Booker. It's a little all over the place. There isn't necessarily, in my mind, a through line there. Tatum, Fox, Curry. So yeah, I think it may be a little more varied in today's game, which makes sense because of the way we space the floor too. So it's just a different game. And again, this notion of nostalgia for the 90s or whatever it was, the way it was reffed or the way they played, you know, the people want to say they didn't allow, travels that they do now. It's like, that's ridiculous. I see plenty of times where they make calls back then, or they blew calls they didn't call for traveling back then. But then on the flip side, they'd call traveling on plays that were not traveling, even by that standard back then. But it looked a little bit weird, and I caught a couple in this game. And nobody should want that. We should not want referees quick whistling, you know, plays they weren't completely sure of for a travel. You should not want that. You should not want the game to stop every other play and have to deal with all the interruptions. So that's the problem. Like I think they figured that out. It's much better now anyway. But again, people are going to be, you know, nostalgic for something in their past and complain, I guess. But here we are.
I just looked at 1983 for the points per game, 1 through 10, small forward. Terry Cummings is the only like power forward, small forward, but 1 through 10 is small forward. I think that people just, you know, especially when people come up with these random stats of the day or whatever the case may be, it's all in an attempt to discredit the past.
Yeah.
Only because people believe that like the past is this golden era. Like you said, they kind of romanticize it, but without romanticizing it with the actual lens that they should look at. Like you don't want it to be what it was in the 80s. You don't want it to be what it was in the 90s. You don't want all these travels or carries or, you know, point guards coming in to do floaters on 7 foot. You don't want that. But with that, people discredit it. And to a fault, because MJ was a great defender. I don't think people need to go to the extent of saying, like, you know, we're done with the 90s. Michael didn't have a left hand. That was a big one this year, too. Michael didn't have a left
hand. Yeah. Did you see the headline of the inflated steals article?
No, what was it?
LeBron was in the title for no reason. Like, the title was about, you know, the discrepancy between steals and Jordan's DPOY season. The second sentence was, was LeBron chasing a ghost this whole time?
I'm like, yeah. Okay, I did see that. Yeah.
I'm like, why?
Oh, I forgot that. Yeah, I mean, it really comes down to one guy, right? It really comes down to LeBron. I mean, maybe Kobe. I don't know. And you know, that's the nature of sports, I suppose. But I can't think of any other time when this was like a thing that was happening. And you know, listen, LeBron is 1B in my mind. You know, he's Michael has to be 1A. He's 1B. So there's no shame in being in that position. But yeah, when you want to kind of change the reality of what happened back then to suit that narrative, that's a problem too. You know, and by the way, they're not making anything up in that article. They're it's clear he got more, you know, blocks and assists and steals and home. But the context is okay. Let's look at the video footage then, and let's see was he playing defense well? Because you know, I think you know because LeBron's defense is so bad now. Can I say that?
That's crazy.
It's bad, right? LeBron's defense is bad. It's bad now. Well, I got to lash out and make someone else bad. You know, I don't know. That's sort of what it feels like to me. Michael's defense was never bad. Like in 1998, he was still playing defense better and playing more minutes and all that stuff than these guys did. I'm not even saying that's a good thing either. Look at Thibodeau and what's going on in New York. They overplay, they all break down and then happens. But, you know, I don't see that it's hard to understand that a little bit in my mind. I mean, I get it and I whatever, but yeah, I think that's part of it. I think that's, you know, they're tired of hearing LeBron getting maligned, whatever. And, you know, listen, he's playing so much longer than anyone else has played. Like I give him a break. Like, you know, he can't play defense, but that goes back to my original point maybe, which is a team with LeBron James and AD isn't as good as we might think it is now in today's game, because they're not as effective as they used to be.
Wait, And this is truly the last thing. So you're telling me when you were in high school, college, you know, that age range or whatever the case may be, you and your peers did not go back and say, Wilt Chamberlain, overrated. Bob Pettit, they played plumbers.
We did. Here's what I used to say. You ready? Are you sitting down? I used to say, I wish I can go back in time so I can go kick Bob Cousy's ass.
Oh.
I swear to God, that's what I'd say back in high school.
Worcester.
Now, what I was thinking was I'd come down and I'd do like a tween and like he'd fall down, right? That's what would happen. Like they wouldn't have ever seen that. But, you know, listen, Bob Cousy was good, man. And he was doing some tweens and behind the back stuff, right? Like he wasn't completely not doing that. But I used to say that all the time. Here's the thing that blew my mind the other day. The distance between me and George Mikan is the same distance as like a high schooler to Jordan now.
Damn.
And, you know, when I was in high school, George Mikan, like, we didn't have footage. You couldn't watch it. Heck, the Bulls had a really good team in the 70s that was mythical because no one had footage. We'd only heard of Jerry Sloan and Norm Van Leer and whatever. I forgot who the other guys. You know what I mean? Like, we could hear about it. We could read about it. We never saw any footage. So we didn't know anything about any of these guys. But yeah, there's no question what we were doing that. And then, but the whole plumbers thing now about the 80s, I mean, oh my Lord, even in the 70s, there were athletes in the 70s, man. Like I can't even begin to tell you, like there were certainly enough of them where if you're going to find that the random, you know, Chuck Nevitt or whatever, who was like this, you know, I don't know if you don't remember him, but you know, not an athlete, you know, you can find a few of those guys, but dear Lord, they had plenty of athletes out there who were as good as they are now, and I think that's silly. So you know, but that happens. By the way, I don't think the guy ever doubted like the athletic ability, even in the 60s, which is probably really bad then. I just felt like the skill level then in the 80s, late 80s, would have been good enough to like they wouldn't be able to handle that, right? I probably was completely misguided. I think.
I can only imagine you going back in time, coming down court. I got this. Tween, tween. And he's just still there. You're like, oh.
Yeah. Even in the 50s, at least they were still shooting like two-handed set shots. They weren't really jumping as much. The late 40s when they started jumping on jump shots, or like in early 40s. So there is a time frame when my high school player, my high school self could go back and dominate, you know, the best version of the basketball. But it wouldn't have been in the 60s. but yes, at any rate, there's a whole conversation we can have about that. I'm thinking about maybe doing some sort of documentary about it, or a pod about it, where, you know, even like the referees, the way the referees called the game. So we talk about all the carries and all that stuff. You'd see Elgin Baylor do a carry or do a crossover and they call it carry, right?
Yeah.
Do we have time for this? Cause I don't want to go over or whatever, but
I'm not gonna stop you. Go ahead.
All right. Good, don't stop. So you've seen those footage, right? This is what some of those guys, other YouTube channels will do these, you know, historical things, and they'll show like Elgin Baylor does a crossover and they call it carry, right? Mm-hmm. So do you know why, like back in the day then, do you know what the reason was for that? Why they'd say it was, oh, it's, of course it's a carry. Do you know what the reason was?
Weren't they just like really strict on it has to be up and down?
On top of the ball, right?
Yeah.
So I'm like, okay, this is interesting. There's a rule in the rule book, I guess, that dictates that your hand has to be on top of the ball. Let's go find this rule. So I actually went and I got rule books from every decade. This is from the 50s, a rule book, right? Mm-hmm. I went and got every rule book. I'm like, where is this rule? Here's the 40s. Where is this rule? And the 50s, 60s, 70s. Where's this rule that says your hand has to be on top of the ball? And guess what? It's not in there. Now, what it does say is you can't pause and you can't have your hand underneath the ball. Okay, great. Mm-hmm. Did that ball pause when he did a crossover? Hell no. So what was going on was a group of these referees, I believe, got together, and whether it was sanctioned or not, and said, hey, we're going to call the game a certain way, even though it doesn't specifically say that in the rule book. Now, was there a team in that era that was doing fancy ball handling stuff on games? Was there?
The Globetrotters, I guess.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
That was right. The Globetrotters. So you can picture a bunch of probably crew-cutted referees, probably in the South, all getting together and saying, we're not going to let that in our game, right? So we're going to call this stuff. Now, independent of the racial overtones, undertones, whatever you want to call it, of that, because remember, they banned the dunk for 10 years in high school and college. You remember this?
Mm-hmm.
1968 to 1978. Do you know what that coincided with? Do you know why they decided to ban the dunk?
Because of that will.
Kareem. So Kareem comes in, dunks over everybody, and then they say, whoa, 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 we can't have this. Now, George Mikan dunked on people. Were they banning the dunk then? No. Now, the reason why I get more upset about this is that the way they decided to call the ball handling stuff, this BS thing, hand on top of the ball, you know, it basically it set back dribbling ability for decades. Because all of us growing up were convinced you had to have your hand on top of the ball. So we didn't develop good ball handling skills because of that. You know, when I can teach dribbling now, and it's so easy because I can explain, remember, we're going to go through your legs. Well, where does your hand have to be? On the side of the ball. Then you can propel it a lot better. When you understand that, at least there's always these random players that were just great at ball handling, right? No matter what, like, you know, with all the whatever drills, that it just made sense. But for a lot of people, it was really hard. And so now we can unlock a lot more of that, and it makes it a lot easier to coach. But all we're doing is following the rules. So back then, they were not following the rules. And everyone believed it. They thought it was. And no one had the rule books with them. And so as a result, it changed the way the game was played. And it had a lot of racial overtones, unfortunately. And the dunking thing, especially a good starting out point. Can you believe that Dr. J was not allowed to dunk once in his college career? It was outlawed the whole time he was at UMass. Not one dunk you'll ever see from him in college. That's a crime. And by the way, I'm also interested as part of the documentaries. I kind of want to know what the meeting was, because I can get the meeting to put the rule in. I can kind of get that late 60s tumultuous civil rights movement. There's probably a lot of coaches in there, you know, with Southern accents, you know, saying we can't have this. But I want to know what the room looked like in 78 when they allowed it again. because, you know, they had to have coaches who were still against the dunk and still wanted to keep it out of the game. And I want to know what that back and forth looked like. There might be some people still alive from that, because that would probably be really interesting as well. So there's my little history lesson there about that. But it's fascinating because it reverberates all the way until now in terms of, you know, how we had to deal with that. Allen Iverson comes in and probably is the guy, right, that finally pushes this notion of where we can have our hand on the ball, right? You know, that really helped. But he was also maligned for a lot of reasons that were unrelated to basketball. So at any rate, you know, we have a great game, and it continually evolves, and I'm all for it. I love when we come up with newer and more interesting things to bring to the table that are creative and are, within the rules and all that stuff that we realize that are legal. So anyway, that was, forgive me for talking that long, but that was, that's what's going on. That's where we got to. That's how we got here.
I thought that was very interesting. And now we're here at Tyrese Halliburton and Jordan Poole.
Now, listen, the carry thing has got to be cleaned up, man. I'm telling you right now, the carries, I will be an old head on that one. It is bad, because you know what, it does pause. That's pause. I'm the king. If you follow me on Twitter, I have to walk people through, and I do. I don't know why. Tell me not to, please. Would you DM me next time and tell me stop responding to these people? But I do it because I'm trying to help people understand. You know, it's hand from the side of the ball, not underneath. The ball didn't pause. It's not a whatever that half court shot that Peyton Pritchard hits, right? I would travel. It's like it really wasn't a travel. So so I'm that guy who's trying to help understand that, so that we can get to the next level. Like, there's probably even things we haven't thought about. Those crazy, you know, shots from the Philippines where you see guys doing incredible stuff and, like, you know, leaping across the court, whatever. It's legal. Like, a lot of that stuff is legal by the rule, and that's fun. That's exciting.
What are you doing in the country? I'm Filipino. Yeah, what's going on in the country?
He says, you know that one guy who has like a hat on, and he'll say, is this a travel? Now he'll do something crazy. So they have like a Filipino version of it as well. And they'll do some, because James Harden did it 1 year, but they'll do some like leap, but the ball is like faked here. And then they'll go to the ball and people are like, whoa, that is a crazy travel. It's not a travel though.
I know Anthony Edwards started doing the 1-2 euro, but
the pause step. Yeah,
the pause step. So
can I hear? My buddy Chip the ref, who's on my show all the time, just sent me this, and I'm wondering if can I
send it to me on Twitter?
Maybe I can do this. Will it let me do this? Here's what I'm gonna do. Ready? If we have a second, this is you're not gonna believe it. This is legal. This is legal on all levels, according to him, because it's all depends on when you end the dribble. So here, let me do this. Let me open this up, and you'll be able to see this, right? Let me do this. So here, share screen. You're not going to believe this. This is a legal. Share screen window. Are you ready? Can you see this?
Yeah.
Yeah. What the?
But look what he does. He doesn't end the dribble until he's in the air. And at this point, he hasn't jumped, right? Technically, because you have a live dribble, you're taking out as many steps as you like. Only when he ends the dribbles when you gotta start counting steps. Well, at this point, the dribble ended, right? You can see that it ends after he's in the air. Mm-hmm. There. Mm-hmm. Now, this is this first foot down in at all levels is the pivot, the left. Yep. And he's allowed to lift that pivot foot and jump. And that's all he does. So imagine that. Now, this is crazy, and you have to do this with nobody in front of you, so there's no defense, but that is legal at all levels.
What's funny about these videos is there's like a good amount of them that are like, there is no need to do this. Like, all up. Yeah, but they do it. I watch stuff like this. It's interesting.
But some of those could inspire a real move. That's the thing I get excited about. You might be able to take a little bit of it, which is how the game has evolved for everybody, right? Everyone took something from here and something from there. So that's why it's exciting to at least, you know, wrap your head around what the rules are, how they work, what you can get away with, and then maybe that'll start to filter in. I love that. I mean, by the way, it's basically the Harlem Globetrotterization of the game, and I'm convinced you can run the high post offense that they ran in a real game. Like, you know, why not? Like, how fun would that be if you got that good? Imagine that. You'd have to be that good that the other team would be like the Washington Generals in a way, and you're cutting back door. It's all that stuff. So I love the fact that we could take stuff from the 30s and 40s, which is like the triangle offense, for instance, mix it with the modern skill level individually, and then you get something even better than you ever could imagine from back then. That's what excites me about it. That's why I still have, you know, I have books of, you know, this is a book from the 1920 with the origin of the triangle offense in here. And I look at this, I study it, and, you know, there's diagram. Look, there's crazy diagrams written out, you know. Look at that. Is it in focus?
I think Darvin Ham draw that up.
Yeah, right. So, you know, there's always something you can learn from even back then. And there's some smart guys back then.
Is there a logical reason as to why no one has perfected the skyhook since Kareem? Because I've always asked that too. Like, is this a unique shot to him, or is it not as effective as we think it is? Or
we all shot it. I used to shoot a lefty running hook across the lane, and I had a coach tell me not to do it, and I was really good at it. And you know what? Maybe that's what happened to everybody. It's kind of like if you're in kindergarten and you were all finger painting, everyone's a good artist. And at some point, someone's like, no, that's not how you do it. Let me show you. And they take the pen out of your hand and they draw it for you. And now your inner artist is killed, right? That happens. I was a teacher. I've seen it happen at older ages. So it's possible that, yes, like at some point, you know, a coach said something that indicated, oh, I shouldn't be doing that. We've certainly lost the art. Like the way to teach it isn't really out there. I had a really big center on my team, my high school team, years in 2011, 2012. And I wanted to teach him the skyhook. I'm like, you're going to be the guy that's going to bring it back. And he started to do it. But when I first started trying to teach it, I didn't have any reference. You know, I think I have one book that I got from the 80s that I had when I was growing up that has Kareem talking about it. But it's still images, right? It's kind of hard to like figure out, you know, like it's better when it's video. You can watch the whole thing. Mm-hmm. So I think that's part of it. I think that's lost. It's almost like, you know, like the Jedi's lose whatever. Somebody, whatever that lore is, where you kind of lose the book and no one knows how to do it anymore. I think that's what happened. It probably is some relation to like the underhand free throw is it looks weird. So they don't want to do it. And so the sky hook looks weird. I remember, though, speaking of lifting your pivot foot legally to jump, I was trying to show it to him. And I'm like, well, you know, you can't just step and shoot it because that's a travel. You got to dribble it. And once you dribble it, now you got to take an extra step or two and you're getting farther across the lane. It was hard. But it turns out he didn't have to dribble it. He could just lift his pivot foot, raise it, jump and shoot it like Kareem did a lot of for all those years. And I didn't, you know, maybe that was actually YouTube was around, but for some reason I didn't even notice it. But only when I finally went through this with like Devin Williams and the referees and stuff on the court, did I really wrap my head around, oh my goodness, yes, we can pick up our pivot foot as long as we shoot or pass. And that's the big, you know, one I have to try and help with people on Twitter. So as a result, if people think that that's a travel, then they're not going to teach the skyhook that way either. Because once you start to dribble, you kind of get beyond the midcourt line. Like if you start on one block and now that the hook is a little bit harder, it's weird. You got to kind of rotate more, but once you can just catch it and just step and shoot it, now you're like right in the front of the rim and shoot it. So, someone needs to bring it back. No question at all. I think it would be, it could be really, really a really great shot. Terry Cummings, you brought up by the way, who was, you know, he was a power forward, I guess. He had a really great like jump hook where he would just do like a 2-footed hook, right? We don't see that anymore either. And that was like he did that, you know, 4 times a game for a bunch of points.
The closest player would be Robin Lopez Bissos. He's had the highest hook shot percentage in his career since joining the NBA.
I just find it weird because I'm not looking for someone to be Kareem in terms of that being their go-to move, but like why couldn't SGA use like a consistent running hook in his game? Why couldn't Jokic go to it more?
Like Kuzma had it. You know what? Actually, this is interesting. And again, you got to cut me off if we're going too long, although I'm good. All those guys had these sweeping hooks across the lane, like all the guards, and they go in, right? And there was no question. And we see it sometimes. We've seen somebody does it. Who does it? Kuzma? No, somebody. Kuzma might have done it once.
Kuzma did it. Definitely
Kyrie did it as a game winner this year, low key. But
yeah, so every once in a while we do see it, right? And that's there's hope. But no question that needs to come back. And by the way, so you know how we attack on the catch, right? The triple threat is dead. You don't catch the ball, rip through, wait for the defense to come catch up to you. So we all attack on the catch. Well, I started developing the same kind of attack in the post because why am I going to catch it, turn, dribble 3 times, bash into the guy, whatever? When I start to split my feet in the post, it's like you can't stop that guy. And then I started looking at some old footage and I realized that's what they did back then. They would do all post moves like on the run. So they'd flash across the lane and they'd catch it like, you know, in the like near the block. and then sort of just go right in their move and like a hook shot off the glass like that. So that's the kind of stuff we should be teaching as well. Maybe like Levine does it, Zach Levine. Somebody else does it, and I can picture it, and it makes me so happy to see like that running hook off of 1 foot when you're off a drive almost. So and then, you know, by the way, then you'll see guys like Jalen Brunson turn a drive into a post up.
Yeah.
The video on this. Mm-hmm. And that's also genius, right? Like you get cut off. Okay, now we're into our whole Kevin McHale stuff, right? Which back in the day you wouldn't have done unless you were like parked on the block, call for the ball, you know, got it, take your three dribbles and whatever, and then do it, right? Instead, it's like, okay, I'm driving. Now I'm into my game. I got to talk to him about it because I'm desperate to figure out how he came up with this because this is like, you know, I don't think anyone else is doing it.
It has to be his dad. It's a great way to get positioned. I think to your point, B-Souls, the only reason why people don't do these things or whatever the case may be is totally just due to exposure. Like if you don't have this footage, if you don't have this knowledge, if you don't have whatever the case may be, one, you're not even going to think to replicate it, or two, you won't even be able to put your creativity on it. I mean, that's how like a kid, even now, if you go to a park, you'll see like 5-year-olds shooting a basketball that far. One, they've seen Steph Curry shoot, but then to get their creativity on it, they're like, okay, well, I can't get the ball to the rim the same way Steph does, but if I do this, I can get it there.
Yeah.
And so while, and I'm not saying that's like good shooting form or anything like that, it's their creativity telling them like, yo, this is how you can replicate this in a way that will fit you. So if they don't know that, like, yo, you see
Paul
people.
Paul George ain't never done it. So
yeah. Steve Nash doing this, like, I don't know, this could be how Jalen Brunson got to it too. You see Steve Nash doing this, just once you get right here, just post up. Just stop, post up, take two dribbles, and then just finish the basketball. But that's because he was kind of exposed to it. That's my thought process, at least.
But you also have coaches who say, well, you know, Steph Curry is special. You can't do what he does, which is like, it's silly. It's ridiculous, right?
Yeah.
If you play tennis, as soon as one guy comes out doing something a little bit different that they notice, everybody emulates. They all reverse engineer that, and then we start playing that way. But for some reason in basketball for so long, you had that kind of mindset from a lot of people because, again, there's no test you have to take to be a coach, right? You can just be a coach. And a lot of these guys are suboptimal, and they destroy that creativity. And I think the big fear now is with kids growing up, there isn't any creativity because they're all either on the screens. And when they are playing, it's in a regimented practice setting with, like, drills versus just free play. And there might be something to that, you know, but that might still be a thing that's been around for a lot longer than people think, like before screens. I mean, I don't know. I can remember when I was coaching in the late 90s in L.A., you know, the kids wouldn't watch basketball. Like they didn't watch Laker game the night before. So I try and talk to them about it. And like, yeah, I didn't see it. They didn't, you know, it was weird. It was like a disjointed sense of that. Whereas when I was growing up, I mean, we were voracious. The worst part about it was, Chicago didn't have cable until 87. So I couldn't see anything other than like a Bulls game and whoever they happen to be playing until then. Right. Like, so I, you know, all the Western Conference people, like I had never really got a chance to watch much besides like a random highlight on the local. I didn't have ESPN, the local sports channel, whatever, sports news. So that was frustrating at that end. So there's always been these moments in every different era. You know, I have in this book here from 1920, he complains about the players not listening and playing hard. You know, so it's like that lament has always been the same. We always are going to complain about these kids these days, right? It's the same. It doesn't change. So maybe it's the coach that needs to change a little bit.
I know Damo will resonate with this, and I know guys, but I know Damo will resonate with this. Have you ever been playing a guy who you could clearly tell was a drill guy? Like his moves almost looked formulaic. Like he knew as soon as I get here, I need to put it into my left hand. And I think that's that whole concept of like taking away the free play, or the kids don't free play anymore. Cause really, and I'm not some star basketball player, whatever the case may be, but I found my game through free play. It wasn't cone drill this, cone drill that. But I know guys who did do like crazy drill heavy stuff. And you can see it in their game that like they're, I guess, overthinking their move, or they know, all right, once I get here, I have to put it in my left. In order to spin back right.
They're not reacting to the defense. They just want to do like a spin move to a finger.
You don't have to work very far. You find those guys in the NBA right now.
Andrew Wiggins? No, oh, stop. Okay. All right.
Oh, maybe even some
of the finals. So. Wait, so, Tatum? Are you referring to Tatum? Because that's what Omar was referring to when we had that convo. Might be JT. Drew Hanlon, what did you do to my guy, man?
Oh, no. Drew. Well, I don't think you can't say what did you do to him. He's had him the whole time, right? So that's, you know, listen, Drew is a buddy of mine. His guys are all the top scorers in the world, right? So it's like, you know, you can't criticize the guy that these guys score better than anybody in the world, right? Mm-hmm. But we do see the robotic stuff and the free play. Listen, I remember screwing around when I was playing in high school, and I do all sorts of crazy stuff. In fact, I won a game on a three, on a step back three. It was as step back as James Harden's the three in 1988. Okay. Ask me how many times I practiced that shot after I hit that game winner. Zero. Never even considered it. Why? I could have been James Harden. I could have been the next James Harden if I had just practiced that shot, because I was a really good three-point shooter, but never really off the dribble. They wouldn't let you, but it was like at the very end of the game and whatever. And for full disclosure, I thought we were down by two. It was really weird. I thought we were down by two. I thought we were down by three. And so I'm like, oh, I got to hit this just to tie it. And then when it went in, I looked up, we won. We were actually only down by two. So it was a game winner. Anyway, the point being that, like, the coach didn't pull me aside. Hey, I like that shot. Let's look at that again. Let's do that. No, we had no creativity. We had no sense of that anyway, even if you were free to play in this screwing around. Like I would imitate Dr. J, and I can make these crazy, like, reverses on the way down. But I would never dare shoot that in a game. So at least now it does feel like there is more freedom, right? Like kids can now, certainly I encourage it. I mean, heck, my drills now are like drive, jump in the air, and then fire the ball across the court to the corner for a three. Like, you know, I'm trying to get them to do all the things that they wouldn't let us do back in the day. And so we're catching up. And which is, again, the 10-year-olds today that are getting that training when they're 20 and 22, oh my goodness, like that, we the game will again not resemble what we see. We're going to see everybody throwing no look passes, right? Like, yeah. Luka and like Trey, all those guys. We're going to, you know, all the things that he's only, you know, we're going to see jump passes all over the place.
Yeah.
We're going to see deeper and deeper threes. We're going to see one footed threes, which is my other fetish, right? Which allows you to get even farther back. It's going to look crazy. And so that's the question. It's going to look like, when you watch those futuristic movies of 1,000 years from now, when they're in space and they're looking at some game, or like, what is that? Can't figure it out. That's what basketball is probably going to be like. And it's probably what someone in the 40s would say if they looked at what we're doing now. They recognize the ball, maybe. Although the ball in the 40s had stitches on it. It didn't even bounce perfectly because they had stitches on it, like a football. Mm-hmm. Listen, I don't even – can you even use this? It's so long. How are you going to be able to use this and publish this as a piece of content? I hope you can.
we're definitely going to make use of it.
All right.
Coach Nick, we appreciate you. Round of applause, B-Souls. Round of applause.
Oh, thank you, thank you.
I would say tell people where you're at, but they know where you are. E-ball breakdown. There we go. With that being said, bye, guys. And I'm going to hit end recording.